disaster, the next catastrophe, and the next story. What remains in the suburb of Wilkinsburg, near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is a vast psychic and emotional chasm of hatred, fear, and loss, stemming from the recent shootings of five white men, allegedly at the hands of a 38-year-old black man named Ronald Taylor. According to media accounts, Mr. Taylor erupted in anger at a maintenance man at his apartment, shot him, torched his own home, and then embarked on a one-man rampage that left five people wounded, three of them fatally. Almost immediately came reports that the man was a racist, insane, or both. The fast food form that media takes today issued pop psychological diagnoses that were quick, provocative, and ultimately unsatisfying. The race for speed often sacrifices depth and meaning, yet this is the defining characteristic of the contemporary media. Why did this carnage happen? I don't know. Is Mr. Taylor insane? I don't know that either. Mr. Taylor may hold the answer to the first question. The second may be answered after an examination by mental health professionals. No reporter can honestly make these determinations without taking the time to learn the answers, for they too don't know. These simplistic one-note fast food media McNuggets of misinformation provide a false sense of solace to those many gripped in fear and anxiety in the wake of the shootings. Why, he's crazy, some assert, and while the claim is calming, it answers nothing. Former Massachusetts prison official and psychiatrist Dr. James Gilligan noted in his book, Violence, Reflections on a National Epidemic, published in 1996, what actually provoked violence, and I quote, "I have yet to see a serious act of violence that was not provoked by the experience of feeling shamed and humiliated, disrespected and ridiculed, and did not represent an attempt to prevent or undo this loss of face, no matter how severe the punishment, even if it includes death. For we misunderstand these men at our peril if we do not realize they mean it literally when they say they would rather kill or mutilate others, be killed or mutilated themselves, than live without pride, dignity, and self-respect. They literally prefer death to dishonor," unquote. Does this reflect Mr. Taylor's inner life? We cannot now know, but Dr. Gilligan surely provides some valuable insights. For what is black life in contemporary America if not a constant exercise in humiliation? What did the acquittal of the four killer cops of Amadou Diallo mean except a collective communal loss of face? The right to walk a street, to drive a car, or even stand in one's doorway comes dangerously close to the commission of a capital crime in some U.S. cities. Again. What's up? Hold it.
Said you're not allowed to be talking to a radio station.
I know.
That was the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal being censored by a prison guard at SCI Green Prison in Pennsylvania, where he is an inmate on death row. The case of Mumia Abu-Jamal has drawn international attention and support. Groups like Amnesty International have intervened on behalf of his demand for a new trial. Mumia's case is now in federal court after being denied appeals in the state of Pennsylvania court system. Who is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and how did he end up on death row? I'm going to read from a biographical piece written by Terry Bisson for New York Newsday in 1995, titled The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Bisson wrote, "In 1978, Philadelphia mayor and ex-police chief Frank Rizzo blew up at a press conference, threatening what he called the new breed of journalists. They, referring to the people, believe what you write and what you say," said Rizzo, "and it's got to stop. One day, and I hope it's in my career, you're going to have to be held responsible and accountable for what you do," unquote. What the new breed was doing in 1978 and is still doing today was exposing police misconduct. A cop had been killed in a confrontation between Philadelphia police and the Radical Move organization, the same move that was firebombed by the city 7 years later. And the police version of who shot first hadn't been accepted without question. Rizzo feared a new trend, and he was right. The trend has continued. Today, hundreds of other local scandals have exposed the dark underside of police misconduct nationwide. Ironically, the most prominent of the new breed of journalists at whom Rizzo's outburst was directed is awaiting execution on Pennsylvania's death row, a victim, many believe, of a police frame-up. Mumia Abu-Jamal began his journalism career with the Black Panther Party. The Panthers were the original affirmative action employer, and Mumia, then Wesley Cook, was Minister of Information for the Philadelphia chapter at age 15, writing for the national newspaper. A heady beginning for a West Philly kid. After the Panthers fell apart, helped by a stiff dose of FBI harassment, Mumia turned to broadcasting. He had the voice, the writing talent, and the ambition. And by age 25, he was one of the top names in local radio, interviewing such luminaries as Jesse Jackson and the Pointer Sisters, and winning a Peabody Award for his coverage of the Pope's visit. He was president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists and called One to Watch by Philadelphia Magazine. But Mumia was still a radical. The Philadelphia Inquirer called him an eloquent activist not afraid to raise his voice, and this fearlessness was to be his undoing. His vocal support of Move's uncompromising lifestyle lost him jobs at black stations, and he was forced to moonlight to support his family. The mayor's outburst marked the beginning of a campaign of police harassment that included such subtleties as a cocked finger and a bang-bang from a smirking cop, and escalated to a late-night police beating of Mumia's brother on the street. Mumia was driving a cab that night. It is undisputed that he intervened. It is undisputed that both he and Officer Daniel Faulkner were shot and that Faulkner died. What is in dispute is who killed Faulkner. Mumia says it was someone else, and several witnesses saw another shooter flee the scene. Mumia's legally registered 38 was never decisively linked to Faulkner's wounds. Mumia's murder trial was a policeman's dream. Denied the right to represent himself, he was defended by a reluctant incompetent, who was later disbarred, and who has since filed an affidavit in Mumia's support detailing his delinquencies. Mumia was prosecuted by a DA who was later reprimanded for withholding evidence in another trial. He was allowed only $150 to interview witnesses. But best of all was the judge, a life member of the Fraternal Order of Police. Branded as a defendant's nightmare by the Philadelphia Inquirer, Judge Albert F. Sabo has sentenced more men to die, 31 to date, only two of them white, than any other sitting judge in America. A fellow judge once called his courtroom a vacation for prosecutors because of bias toward convictions. Sabo wouldn't allow Mumia to defend himself because his dreadlocks made jurors nervous. Kept in a holding cell, he read about his own trial in the newspapers. A black juror was removed for violating sequestration, while a white juror was given an escort to take a civil service exam. In the end, all the black jurors but one were removed. A policeman who filed two conflicting reports was never subpoenaed. He was on vacation. Mumia's Black Panther history was waved like a bloody flag. Had he said, "All power to the people"? Yes, he admitted he had said that. Character witnesses like poet Sonia Sanchez were cross-examined about their so-called anti-police writings and associations. Thus, with Judge Sabo's help, an award-winning radical journalist with no criminal record was portrayed as a police assassin lying in wait since age 15. After Mumia's conviction, Sabo instructed the jury, quote, "You are not being asked to kill anybody," unquote, by imposing the death penalty, since a defendant will get, quote, "appeal after appeal after appeal," unquote. Such instruction grounds for reversal since Caldwell v. Mississippi was allowed in Mumia's case. Several of Abu-Jamal's essays deal with America's frantic march toward the death chamber. As he wrote several years ago in the Yale Law Journal, quote, "States that have not slain in a generation now ready their machinery. Generators whine, poison liquids are mixed, and gases are measured and readied." And that was written by Terry Bisson, an excerpt from an article published in New York Newsday in 1995, The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. A comment here. Advocates for Mumia's cause focus on two things, the biased nature of his trial and his innocence of the shooting of Faulkner. Let's say for a moment that Mumia had shot Faulkner. Wouldn't he have been justified? I want to ask you for a minute to picture someone you love dearly, who is precious to you. Maybe a brother or sister, a child, parent, a lover, a spouse, or a dear friend. You come along the road, and you see a thug beating your loved one with a club. You have a loaded gun with you. What would you do? Does the fact that this murderous thug has on a uniform make any difference to you? Ironically, the four NYPD officers who gunned down Amadou Diallo were acquitted of murder because they claimed they believed their lives were in danger and the lives of their partners were in danger. Up next, a documentary about Mumia Abu-Jamal by Bruderhof Radio. This looks at the case of Mumia within the context of the American legal system and includes some of his fine radio commentaries. Then we'll look at some excerpts from the report of an international delegation on Mumia's behalf to the U.S. Department of Justice. This document is explosive. Among the evidence compiled by the National Lawyers Guild is a videotape which shows the District Attorney's Office in Philadelphia briefing its staff on how to exclude African Americans from juries as a matter of principle.
Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. Dubbed one of the most inspiring films of the year, Hollywood's latest rendition of prison life is the story of Reuben Carter, the 1960s boxing sensation who served almost 20 years in New Jersey state prisons for a triple murder he never committed. The film, called The Hurricane, has attracted widespread critical acclaim and raised questions in the minds of many Americans as to the true nature of our justice system. But to those more acquainted with the realities of America's courts, Hurricane Carter's story is far from unusual. Since 1976, 82 death sentences have been overturned or commuted, and several states are currently considering measures that would halt executions pending further investigation into charges of police corruption, racial bias, and inadequate public defense. Beneath all the hype is the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a journalist and member of the Black Panther Party who was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. Like Reuben Carter, Abu-Jamal's trial was fraught with injustice, including harassment and coercion of witnesses and concealment of evidence. Sadly, he remains on Pennsylvania's death row, despite widespread international effort demanding a new trial. In this edition of Bruderhof Radio, we'll hear from Abu-Jamal himself as he describes the plight of those trapped inside the justice system. Recently, Abu-Jamal has written about racial biases in the Pennsylvania court system, comparing the treatment of suspected mafia members with that of black revolutionary activists. The following two segments, recorded in January 2000, paint a stark picture of judicial prejudice.
We are all taught that all are equal in the eyes of the law, and for many people, that is their belief. What shatters that belief, however, is the reality of what actually happens in the courts of the land. Not what the courts say, but what they do. Let us examine two cases. The so-called mob in black and white. In 1992, the Pennsylvania Superior Court, in the case Commonwealth versus Scarfo et al., reversed the murder, conspiracy, and weapons charges of eight men who were alleged to be members of the mafia and granted new trials. The state's intermediate appellate court cited a number of reasons for that reversal, among them that the prosecution elicited testimony that the eight men were made mafia members. I quote from the opinion. The Commonwealth chose to focus on the activities of the Mafia and not the activities of the conspiracy. The prosecution elected to employ a strategy whereby it could elicit defendants' prior criminal activities through the back door. The Commonwealth's nomenclature, made membership, totally circumvents the purpose of the rule against admission of evidence regarding prior crimes, end quote. The court also found that the eight men were prejudiced by the prosecutor's references to them in closing argument as wolves, a wolf pack, and similar animal imagery. Such terms serve to dehumanize the accused, said the court, and the Scarfo court wrote, justice in this case requires reversal for a new trial because the defendants were not treated with fundamental fairness. In 1995, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided Commonwealth versus Jones, a case involving a man said to be head of the JBM, or Junior Black Mafia. Throughout the trial, witnesses and prosecutors made repeated references to the JBM and attributed to them a number of separate offenses, including murder. On appeal, when Jones tried to argue that errors in his trial were similar to those made in Scarfo, the court thought otherwise. There, the court ruled, such repeated references to JBM weren't prejudicial, but factual, and testimony to other crimes were merely harmless. Two trials, two results. Two appeals, two results. Two different standards of what prejudice means. Two mobs, one white, another black. Two different kinds of justice. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Many are unfamiliar with the reality of Death Row, for the corporationist press paints a picture of the row as an abode of the worst of the worst, while a truer picture is of those who are poorest of the poor, or even the weakest of the weak. How so, you ask? Well, look, of all the kinds of killings that people do, what can be more malevolent than murder for hire? In Philadelphia alone, dozens of people have been slain in the streets as local mafia wars raged for over a decade. Which leads to another question. How many mafia hitmen were in Pennsylvania's death row? The answer, zero. Not one. How can this be, you ask? And the answer is simple. Real mafia guys are able to afford the best lawyers that money can buy, while the poor schmuck is stuck with court-appointed lawyers, hardly the craft's best. So, guess who goes to death row? Death row, it seems, is the prerogative of the poor. And what about mafia hitmen? Truth be told, there was one once, and the DA's office in Philadelphia fought harder than most defense lawyers to get him off the row. Sure enough, quietly, they did so. In fact, he never lived under the deprivations that are familiar to all people on death row. Why? Because he testified against his alleged bosses. What emerges is the politics of death, that the well-to-do and well-connected can afford to escape, and where one's poverty is a definitive aggravating circumstance. I've written previously of the Fred Thomas case, of the diabetic grandfather whose witness in his defense was run out of court by cops later convicted in the infamous 39th District corruption scandal, of young Jimmy Dennis, whose alibi defense was tossed aside by the courts, innocent men whose real offense was not being able to afford adequate defense counsel. And I assure you, they are not alone. Death Row is not just a poor place, but a predominantly black place, with most from Philadelphia. Again, we see the politics of death.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Of prosecutors and judges who seek political advancement on the basis of their fierce allegiance to the death penalty, except it seems when it comes to mafia hitmen. These same actors in the containment system have treated the Supreme Court's Batson case as little more than a joke. Batson allegedly outlaws using race as the basis for the removal of potential black jurors. But as a video training tape for the DA's office showed, the same game goes on by another name and with the same effect, predominantly white juries. Clearly, what the case claims and what the courts of the Commonwealth actually do are two very different things. And the result is predictable. Death. Clearly, unquestionably, this is time for a change. I thank you. On a move, long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Until recently, the change Abu Jamal refers to seemed very far away indeed. Last year, 98 people were executed in the United States, the most in 1 year since reinstatement of the death penalty in 1976. In several states and at the federal level, steps have been taken to speed up the execution process and limit appeals for men with a date to die. Here, in a piece recorded on January 9th, Abu Jamal addresses a group of German activists about yet another negative trend he sees in America, the execution of juveniles.
In the month of January 2000, several young men, who were juveniles at the time of their offenses, will be put to death by Texas and Florida. What kind of nation kills its own kids? America is that kind of nation. It matters not what any international convention or treaty may say. Those boys will be dead before the month changes into February. Why should any of this matter to you who live in other countries other than the U.S.? What has this to do with you? Well, as a recent battle in Seattle has shown, the forces that are straining to restrict, repress, and commodify human and other lives is a global one, one which moves in darkness and in secret. Now, if repression is global, why not, too, isn't resistance? If the interest of capital to make global profits is an important one, why not the simple human right to life? As the ways of business dictate the broader rules under which all life is to be lived on this planet, why not the ways of resistance? Why is it not life that takes precedence over profit? People abroad are well placed to call the U.S. on the deep death culture that obtains here. Criticism from within the country, if at all, is muted. For America is a nation obsessed with legalism, devoid of any national tradition of kings. All that is deemed legitimate comes from written law. Why do you think the U.S. took almost a half century to sign the anti-racism and anti-genocide conventions? In a move that guts the spirit while embracing the letter, Congress passes such accords with what they term reservations. That's conditions that transform such pacts into meaningless scraps of paper that no judge, no court, no institution need respect. As this is an election year in America, there's a rush to death, for nothing improves a politician's position as much as an execution. Would that there was such a mobilization on behalf of life. Your actions, therefore, on behalf of life, become vitally important to reflect back the unflattering picture of the American culture of death, where over 3,500 men and women await death at the hands of the state, where among that number, some 80 youth, 17 years old and younger, await the gallows. From you may come that which does not yet exist in the U.S., an ethic of life.
Despite his candid analysis of the American death culture, Abu Jamal is quick to acknowledge signs of hope. He sees the recent death penalty moratorium declared by Illinois Governor George Ryan as evidence of a shift in public opinion and hopes other states will follow suit. For this to happen, he says, many more stories of innocence and wrongful conviction must come to the surface. One such story is that of Abu Jamal's fellow inmate, Fred Thomas.
It is increasingly easy to stereotype the men and women on death row. The state does it every day, as does the press. Those banished to the most exclusive club in America are deemed worthy of damnation, and in truth, all are presumed guilty, for did not a jury say so? Then one meets Fred Thomas, 53-year-old great-grandfather, who was projected to a jury as homeless, heartless, and in the words of the DA, quote, a predator, unquote. In a brief, week-long trial that went poorly defended, a jury convicted Fred of first-degree murder. And a day later, on February 28, 1995, sent Fred to death row in Pennsylvania. Now, why should one care about a homeless, heartless predator? Clearly, the jury didn't. What the jury never learned was that an eyewitness, located the day after the killing of a FedEx driver in the so-called Badlands of North Philly, gave a statement to the cops that she witnessed the shooting, named two of the assailants, and described the third, none of which remotely resembled Thomas. Indeed, her statement was corroborated by another witness who saw the three men running away. I know. The question arises, well, how did the prosecutor convict this man? Well, in their first attempt, they didn't, for the jury refused to convict and a hung jury was declared. In the second trial, the state provided two witnesses, both crack addicts, who claimed they saw Fred fleeing the scene, but even they couldn't go as far as saying they saw him shoot anyone, or even armed. According to the woman who did see the shooting, however, one of the assailants was related to one of the two witnesses who now placed Fred at the crime scene. These witnesses, both of whom had extensive criminal histories, were not asked about their drug-related activities, despite repeated requests of counsel to do so. A homeless man, desperate for a dollar to survive, might rob and kill a truck driver, as would a drug addict. But Fred wasn't a homeless man, nor an addict, but a hard-working man who worked a variety of jobs to support his growing family. He's innocent of murder. And as this was written, did have a date to die for November 23rd, 1999. He did receive, since this writing, a stay of execution. Now, in truth, this is his second death warrant. But the question arises, will he survive death row? A 53-year-old who recently was diagnosed as diabetic is now insulin dependent. He has one fervent hope. He says, I hope my health don't give up, so I can live long enough to prove my innocence. From death row, this is Mumia Abu.
You're listening to Mumia Abu-Jamal on Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program focusing on progressive thought and activism. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about today's program. You can call us at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. In addition to wrongful conviction like that suffered by Fred Thomas, many inmates face a lengthy appeals process equally doomed to failure. Shaka Sankofa has lived on Texas death row since 1981. The National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty has highlighted his case for its injustice, saying, quote, compelling evidence exists which points to his innocence. Abu Jamal's recounting of this story reveals the horror of waiting for death not once, but many times.
On September 5th, 1999, the man born as Gary Graham marked his 36th year in life and his 18th year in a Texas cage. Several years ago, the black death row prisoner changed his name to Shaka Sankofa after the great founder of the Zulu Empire of Southern Africa. For years, he's been fighting for his life, most recently against one of the most brutal killing states in America. Texas leads the nation in executions, spurred at least in part by the presidential aspirations of its governor, George W. Bush. Supporters from as diverse a grouping as the Pope, the Nation of Islam, and the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty have been critical of some aspects of his trial and called for either clemency or a new trial. Sankofa's trial was marred by conflicting witnesses, ballistics evidence that cleared his weapon from the killing, and even alibi testimony, placing him miles away from the crime scene. Yet much of this wasn't brought out to the jury. Five times Sankofa has faced the gallows, and five times he has been granted last-minute stays of execution. What disturbs many observers is a provision of Texas law that disallows evidence of innocence that does not come within that state's narrow time frame. Supporters of Sankofa have released a CD featuring music and spoken word to support his new trial efforts called Let the Evidence Be Heard. In early September 1999, the Papal Nuncio, Archbishop Gabriel Montalvo, wrote to Texas Governor Bush, asking on behalf of Pope John Paul II that clemency be granted. But even the appeal of a pope may have to yield to an even higher power, the power of human political ambition. That was certainly the case as regards to the late Carla Faye Tucker, whose remarkable rehabilitation was treated like a joke. Shaka Sankofa has spent half of his life not only in a cage, but under threat of death, despite considerable evidence of his innocence. From his perspective, the U.S. is many things, but freedom-loving, it ain't. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For all its glaring inconsistencies, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is emblematic of a wider failure of justice in America. Like the now-famous Reuben Hurricane Carter, Abu-Jamal has spent almost 2 decades serving time for a murder he may or may not have committed. But regardless of his innocence or guilt, it is Abu-Jamal's rare ability to transcend prison walls that has earned him the status of international revolutionary icon. Through his writings, he joins the ranks of men like Hurricane Carter who see the world more clearly from their unique vantage point, the inside of a prison cell. In the following piece, Abu-Jamal offers analysis of the recent battle in Seattle.
According to Pump's reports, the planned meeting of the World Trade Organization was marred by violence, wreaked by thugs, anarchists, and hooligans. The danger of such mainstream media reports, however, is in the reliance upon police and government sources to prepare such material. In a mass action such as the Seattle anti-WTO marches, police are hardly neutral sources, for they are, in essence, combatants. Isn't it simply fair to present both sides? Jim DeSilas, a college student from Portland, reported via payphone to internet typists who sent his observations around the world. His eyewitness account is, to say the least, enlightening. The following are excerpts, quote, "The government instigated a riot to discredit the movement against the WTO because they couldn't dilute it. I am not guessing about this. I was there. I saw it happening. And I will tell you, I am frankly shocked to see close up just how little our leaders care what happens to ordinary people. Clinton can pose and speak a lot of flowery stuff, but the truth is, we are nothing to them. I saw this with my own eyes," unquote. DeSalis' report,
"This call is coming from a correctional facility,"
recounts the aggressive nonviolence of the anti-WTO marchers and compares the single breaking of a McDonald's storefront window favorably to what occurs at a typical rock concert. Police used that instance to launch their attacks against the people. I quote again. "A small group, maybe 100 people total, struck back. Then these cops herded that group around the city, making sure there were plenty of photo ops of violent demonstrators. A number of times, they had these 100 or so protesters caught between buildings and walls of police. They could easily have arrested and detained this small group of people and gotten it over with. Instead, they would gas them and let them go. When you gas a person, let me tell you, it gets them fighting mad. Tuesday night, the police gassed all of downtown. This was going on from 3 p.m. till 6 p.m., gas everywhere. The kids broke a few windows, Mickey D's, Starbucks, small stuff, burned a few garbage cans. The police were using these people as extras. It was staged. I believe also the police had their own people in there, encouraging people to break stuff. If people think I may be exaggerating, I saw supposed protesters. They were screaming and so on. And then later, when everything was over, these same people tackled other protesters and put handcuffs on them," unquote. Well, I bet this report didn't get covered in the corporate media, huh? Meanwhile, protesters, even those who were aggressively nonviolent, were violently gassed, kicked, beat, and shot by peace officers. Is a rubber bullet a nonviolent bullet? Well, people in Northern Ireland certainly don't think so. For there, 14 people were killed, 7 children, by rubber bullets. In Seattle, DeSalas witnessed a cop shoot a man in the mouth, breaking out his front teeth. Do you remember a headline, a TV story, or a radio report calling these violent cops thugs or hooligans? I thought not. How then can the corporate media be trusted? And who is truly violent, one who attacks property or those who hurt people? Kids in Seattle break a half a dozen windows, and the media labels all protesters as violent. Cops beat, gas, shoot, and kick several hundred people. And the media reports they acted with restraint. Cops masquerade as protesters, and the media is silent.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio and the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. More of Abu-Jamal's thoughts and writings are available in his 2 books, titled Live from Death Row and Death Blossoms. To end this edition of Bruderhof Radio, we'll hear a selection from 1996's Death Blossoms, recorded in September 1999. In this segment, titled Common Unity, Abu Jamal offers encouragement to those who remain committed to permanent change.
The revolutionary John Africa, reading from Strategic Revolution, says, "Revolution is not a word, but an application. It is not war, but peace. It does not weaken, but strengthens. Revolution does not cause separation. It generates togetherness." John Africa. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, once said, "Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Unquote. For millions, perhaps billions of us, life is a search, a journey of seeking for that which we found unfulfilled in our youth. We search for love. We search for family. We search for community. And in so doing, we seek the completion of self in others, in the larger self, where similar selves are united in
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
In community. As we search and grow, we find that modern life, with its bursting balloons of materialism, leaves us more and more empty inside. Things that once seemed to fill us now fail to bridge the gaping chasms in our psyche. Our inner selves are pulled in too many ways at once. The demands of work here and social obligations there, the pressures of financial need or the lesser burdens of wealth, public responsibilities, the needs and wants of our private sphere, and finally they break atomized, meaningless. The dominant societal ideology of the hour is a perverse individuality hammered into our consciousness by myth and legend. It ignores the historical verity of community, of groups striving to move the social order forward. It ignores the reality that people working together are the only viable solution to any social problem. As human beings,
2 minutes remaining,
we are at root social creatures. Outside the bonds of our familial and social relations, we cannot truly live. Our very sanity depends on them. We are birthed in and into community. We grow in community. Community determines who we are. It is not the individual self per se, but its place in the broader social network of human society that defines our identity and gives our life meaning. Whether in religious, political, economic, or educational matters, collectivity is a basic requisite for meaning. Can there truly be a religion of one? What political action can be effectively undertaken by a lone person? Doesn't every step toward economic progress require at least some level of social agreement, some willingness to put aside antagonisms for it to function? Doesn't education, especially as it is presently constituted, consist largely of teaching youth how to play by the rules of the broader social order?
Remaining.
Is it purely coincidental that students are organized into classes? Doesn't it teach them how to acquiesce, not how, even whether, to transform the status quo? And what of a circumstance in which the status quo is unfair or oppressive? Such can be said to have given rise to a community of resistance known as the MOVE Organization, which, in the words of its legendary founder, John Africa, has as its reason for existence total liberation.
30 seconds remaining.
The MOVE Organization is a powerful family of revolutionaries, fixed in principle, strong in cohesion, steady as the foundation of a massive tree. A people totally equipped with a profound understanding of simple assertion, collective commitment, unbending direction. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, reading from Death Blossoms.
That's all for this week's Bruderhof Radio. You've been listening to the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. To order Abu-Jamal's books, Live from Death Row and Death Blossoms, call Plow Publishing at 1-800-521-8011. Again, that's Plow Publishing at 800-521-8011. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 800-778-8461. To order tapes and transcripts, call that same number. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount. In particular, the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For further information about the Bruderhof communities, call 1-800-778-8461.
A meeting took place on January 12th in Washington, D.C. between officials of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department and members of the international delegation on behalf of the Committee to Save the Life of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The 12-person delegation presented Justice Department representatives with documentation of civil rights violations in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as petitions asking for a review of his case. Here are a few selected excerpts from the minutes of the meeting. Delegation member Alyssa Wilkins, Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild, spoke about the contents of the documentation prepared by the National Lawyers Guild on violations of Abu-Jamal's civil rights.
What is documented here is the sustained suppression of evidence, the fabrication of evidence, and the manipulation of evidence for the purpose of misleading and inducing conclusions known to be untrue by the police and prosecution. The violations of rights include the manner and conduct of the trial by the prosecutors who concealed material evidence from the defense, and the manner in which the trial was conducted by Judge Albert Sabo, who denied Mumia Abu-Jamal the right to choose his own counsel, examine the jury, investigate the evidence against him, and effectively challenge the prosecution's case. The selection of the jury revealed the denial to the defendant of the right to object and the arbitrary acceptance by the court of jurors who declared their hostility to the defendant and who were unable to be impartial. This constitutes judicial impropriety.
Delegation member Sam Jordan highlighted systemic racism.
I am the director of the program to abolish the death penalty for Amnesty International USA. I wish to point out that the Justice Department has already investigated the conduct of the police in many cities. Statistics concerning the death penalty establish that it is a weapon against the poor and overwhelmingly against African Americans and people of color. The record shows that while only 4% of the population of Pennsylvania, excluding Philadelphia, are black or brown, 70% of death row inmates are black or brown. If Philadelphia is included, the percentage increases to 90%. We also wish to point out that the U.S. Department of Justice has obtained a consent decree in the wake of its investigation of the Pittsburgh Police Department. Other such consent decrees have been obtained by the Department of Justice, where police brutality, corruption, and the violation of citizens' rights have been endemic, institutionalized, and sustained over years. The evidence before the U.S. Department of Justice establishes a pattern revealing the targeting and persecution of black and brown citizens, the overwhelmingly poor, and the disadvantaged. This clear pattern is in itself a violation of the civil rights statutes. It requires a systematic investigation, and it bears directly upon the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Delegation member Ralph Schoenman of International Committee Against Repression presented the smoking gun.
I wish to present you now a video cassette of the Assistant District Attorney in Philadelphia conducting a training instruction for prosecutors in his office. He directs them to keep African Americans from being on the jury, and he instructs them on ways to remove African Americans from the jury. His language is not circumlocutory or circumspect. It is direct and explicit, with in-your-face racist characterizations concerning African Americans' crime rate, job stability, education levels, dress, manner, attitude, and children born out of wedlock in Philadelphia. Prosecutors are instructed that people with certain names and living in certain streets and locations populated by African Americans should be excluded. He then states that prosecutors should keep notes on the pattern of unemployment, children born out of wedlock, early school dropout histories, prior encounters with police and authorities, and family members in trouble. The assistant district attorney states that blacks are not supportive of law enforcement and must be kept off the jury if a case is to be won. He gives tips on how to remove blacks from juries if peremptory challenges have been exhausted and they have survived the gauntlet. Most important, the assistant district attorney states that targeting blacks in this way violates federal law. He instructs them how to offset this by keeping a written record of other kinds of objections, lack of education, steady employment, family stability, etc., using these notes to defend themselves in case they are challenged. This official training session is basic to the conduct of jury selection in the trial record of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The assistant district attorney's instructions were implemented to keep qualified blacks off the jury. The case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is a manifestation of institutionalized racism which strips African Americans of their civil rights and their survival rights at the hands of the police, prosecutors, and courts, which target them, as this training instruction so clearly confirms.
The U.S. DOJ seemed receptive. The information came as no surprise to Deputy Director of the Civil Rights Division, Loretta King. She responded to the delegation.
I find it most interesting that you have been talking about Philadelphia. We have a special concern about police abuse in Philadelphia. In fact, federal funds have recently been allocated specifically for our division to investigate police and official misconduct.
Delegation member Ralph Schoenman also spoke on the biased nature of the Pennsylvania courts.
The abuse of the judicial process to violate the rights of the defendant is evident not only in the flagrant conduct of the trial judge Albert Szabo, but also in the materials which we have submitted to you. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which has refused to acknowledge any of the gross violations documented beyond dispute, has upheld the death penalty conviction, opening the door for the imminent execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The justice on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who has taken the lead in this regard was former Philadelphia District Attorney Ronald Castile, who submitted the papers opposing Mumia Abu-Jamal's earlier appeals. You will find Justice Castile's name on the videotape submitted to you, in which prosecutors are trained on how to remove black jurors and how precisely to conceal the racial motivation. When this conflict of interest was raised, Judge Castile refused to recuse himself. His reasons are instructive. He notes that all the other justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court were endorsed and funded by the Fraternal Order of Police, which has waged a wide public campaign for the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Judge Castile stated, at the outset, I note that the very same Fraternal Order of Police which endorsed me during earlier electoral processes also endorsed Mr. Chief Justice John P. Flaherty, Mr. Justice Ralph Cappy, who wrote the Mumia Abu-Jamal decision for the court, Mr. Justice Russell N. Nigro, and Madam Justice Sandra Schultz Newman. If the Fraternal Order of Police's endorsement constituted a basis for recusal, practically the entire court would be required to decline participation in this appeal. Unquote. It should be noted that this court refused to find a single error in the entire record before it, despite so many flagrant and patent violations of due process and constitutional rights. The full text of the report is available on the Unwelcome Guest website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome.
On May 7th, there will be a day-long benefit concert and teach-in for Mumia Abu-Jamal at Madison Square Garden in New York City. For more information on that or on Mumia's case in general, see mumia2000.org. That's mumia2000.org.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization. But the state, and well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society.
Tell that. at the precinct. You know how we think. Organize the hood under our chain banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the street like watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common needs. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
The black male live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government departments started it in the projects. Material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty be running with. Rather get shot in they back than fire back. We're tired of that. Corporations hiring blacks, denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my raps. It's documented, I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathe in it. It's more than just believing it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and it's CeeLo for push-ups now. Many headed for one conclusion. Ain't ready for revolution.
The average black male live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
We'll close the program today with a preview of the police state of the 21st century. This article by Julie Foster, Big Brother Gets Under Your Skin, was in WorldNet Daily on March 25th.
New implant technology currently used to locate lost pets has been adapted for use in humans, allowing implant wearers to emit a homing beacon, have vital bodily functions monitored, and confirm identity when making e-commerce transactions. Applied Digital Solutions, an e-business-to-business solutions provider, acquired the patent rights to the miniature digital transceiver it has named Digital Angel. The company plans to market the device for a number of uses, including as a, quote, tamper-proof means of identification for enhanced e-business security, unquote. Digital Angel sends and receives data and can be continuously tracked by global positioning satellite technology. When implanted within a body, the device is powered electromechanically through the movement of muscles and can be activated either by the, quote, wearer or by a monitoring facility. Quote, we believe its potential for improving individual and e-business security and enhancing the quality of life for millions of people is virtually limitless, unquote, said ADS Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Richard Sullivan. Quote, although we're in the early developmental phase, we expect to come forward with applications in many different areas, from medical monitoring to law enforcement. However, in keeping with our core strengths in the e-business-to-business arena, we plan to focus our initial development efforts on the growing field of e-commerce security and user ID verification. Dr. Peter Zhu, chief scientist for development of the implant and president of Digital Angel Net, Inc., A subsidiary of ADS told WorldNet Daily the device will send a signal from the person wearing Digital Angel either to his computer or to the e-merchant with whom he is doing business in order to verify his identity. In the future, said Zhu, computers may be programmed not to operate without such user identification. As previously reported in World News Daily, user verification devices requiring a live fingerprint scan are already being sold by computer manufacturers. Digital Angel takes such biometric technology a giant step further by physically joining human and machine. But e-commerce is only one field to which Digital Angel applies. Device's patent describes it as a rescue beacon for kidnapped children and missing persons. According to Zhu, the implant will save money by reducing resources used in rescue operations for athletes, including mountain climbers and skiers. Law enforcement may employ the implant to keep track of criminals under house arrest, as well as reduce emergency response time by immediately locating individuals in distress. The device also has the ability to monitor the user's heart rate, blood pressure, and other vital functions. Your doctor will know the problem before you do, said Zhu, noting peace of mind is possible for at-risk patients who can rest in the knowledge that help will be on the way should anything go wrong. Indeed, peace of mind is Digital Angel's main selling point. Ideally, the patent states, the device will bring peace of mind and an increased quality of life for those who use it, and for their families, loved ones, and associates who depend on them critically. Unquote. Referring to the threat of kidnapping, the patent goes on to say, adults who are at risk due to their economic or political status, as well as their children who may be at risk of being kidnapped, will reap new freedoms in their everyday lives by employing the device. Digital Angel developer told World News Daily demand for the implant has been tremendous since ADS announced its acquisition of the patent in December. We have received requests daily from around the world for the product, Zhu said, mentioning South America, Mexico, and Spain as examples. One inquirer was the U.S. Department of Defense through a contractor, according to Zhu. American soldiers may be required to wear the implant so their whereabouts and health conditions can be accessed at all times, said the scientist.
And that was from the March 25th edition of WorldNet Daily. The music used in today's program was Hang Not by Woody Guthrie and Police State by Dead Prez. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Unwelcome travelers,